Welcome, 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 ladies, gentlemen, and everybody inside and outside of the gender spectrum, as my friend Alex likes to say. This is Victory Through Guts, episode 20, All Grown Up. I think that was the WrestleMania catchphrase for 20. I don't know if it was 20 or 21, but Victory Through Guts 20, that's huge. We've done it this 20 times. We haven't murdered each other, and we talk even more than just this. I'm surprised that I haven't flown out to Ireland and just, you know, can't make that joke. Never mind. Alex, you're here. Hi.
I was going to say, it wasn't WrestleMania 20 where it all begins again, because they did it at, like, Madison Square Garden or some shit.
Yeah, 21 was All Grown Up.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Or maybe 22. I don't know. I was gonna make a Bloody Sunday joke
anyway. So wow, you were gonna go there.
That's why I was like, I can't just say that like it's nothing. But I had to make sure that you knew that was the joke I was gonna say. Oh man, yeah, that's what I mean. I'm a bad person.
Yeah. I mean, listen, once you're not British, it's okay.
I mean, yeah, I'm Irish. None of my ancestors died in Bloody Sunday though, so. Well, I don't know. It doesn't matter.
It was a long time ago.
It was a thing. Finn Balor, big fan of Bloody Sunday. But anyways, we're talking about WrestleMania Pre-Ad this time around. WrestleMania Pre-Ad 1991. It was a show. More interestingly, in my opinion, we also are talking about a documentary episode from a French, TV show about different cultures around the world. We're talking about that. We got subtitled on YouTube and on Google Drive and all that shit, so we watched that. I think that was a bit more interesting, and it sort of surrounds WrestleMania Pre-Ad. That's where it climaxes, but we'll get into that later. We'll get into the actual show first, because, I don't know how much you have from this. I have, like, a decent amount of notes, but, like, in actuality, there isn't a ton to, like, just jump into, in my opinion.
Yeah, like, we could fluff a lot of it, but then, like, of actual substance, I didn't really feel like there was too much, especially since the first two matches weren't on the airing that I had, so...
Yeah, they weren't on any airing, actually.
Yeah, so, like, we only had three, technically four matches to work with, and, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely a contrast to the year prior, where WrestleMania Pre-Ad was, like, genuinely probably the best show we'd watched that year.
Yeah.
It was really, really good. From top to bottom, it had a lot of... It's, like, this feels like a regression. Because, like, the 1990 WrestleMania Pre-Ad felt like that, like, big show feel. You know, like Paul White style? No, like that, like, 93 type feel, where it's, like, they had the ceremony at the jump. There was, like, a big, you know... thing that happened there where Yamato wanted to wrestle but she wasn't cleared, and so Kyoko and Manami Toyota had to wrestle together, and it was like they had to tag together. Like, there was that whole like schmoz at the beginning, and the entire show just felt like a fledged out like super show in a way, and this felt like a show that Bull Nakano was on, and that was it. Like, that was, and even in the documentary, that's sort of how they built it. it is a show that Bull Nakano was main eventing, and it's like, I guess that's enough, but at the same time, from a hindsight point of view, it was kind of lackluster in a way. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, there was better big shows this year. I mean, there was the one with Jungle Jack versus Toyota and Moreno, and I think that entire show was better than this by a long way. The AJW has definitely lost a bit of their quality as the year goes on. But I mean, let's not say that anything's bad. I think they're still doing good things. They just are maybe not using all of their wrestlers to the best of their abilities just yet.
Yeah, I think I agree with that statement, but we can get into the show. Like Alex said, the first two matches were not recorded. Bat Yoshinaga and Tomoko Watanabe, the words, and Tomoko Watanabe defeated Kyoro Ito and Mira Kamea. And also, Atsuka Mita, Saki Asagawa, and Suzuka Minami defeated Mariko Yoshida, Mima Shimoda, and Yumika Hoda. There's a couple matches that happened. We didn't get to see them, unfortunately, but they were on the card. Even if we did get to see them, I still feel like from top to bottom, this was like very like a strange for their big show. A big part of that is that it's in a smaller arena than was the year prior. It has smaller attendance, I believe. I think this one reached 3,000. I feel like WrestleMania 90 was a bit bigger. I did not write it down. Let me check. I can't even spell WrestleMania. Yeah, so the year prior, they had double the attendance. That was the difference, is that at Yokohama Bunka, they had 6,300, whereas this one only had around 3,000. So the atmosphere was different. It felt smaller. And overall, it was just definitely a not as big of a big show, I guess you could call it, in terms of what AEW usually does. But let's get into the actual action that we got to see. First match that we saw was the AJW title match. It was Takako Inoue versus Debbie Malenko. Debbie Malenko. I keep thinking about the documentary where they said, because Debbie lost, she doesn't get paid. And I was like, I don't think that's how wrestling actually works. But no. If it does, that's kind of fucked up. they sold that part real hard in the doc.
Those documentary makers got worked. The documentary guy got worked big time. It's so funny.
Especially they were really focusing on the hair bit, which was very and I'm cool with. I think that obviously nowadays it isn't as huge, but at that point it was a pretty big deal for women to cut their hair, especially Bison, because she had very long, beautiful hair. But like Asha, she was already she had short hair, she had shorter hair than I do currently. I don't know. They really sold that as a true embarrassment, and I was like, okay, but we'll get into that later. The match was Takako Inoue and Debbie Malenko. I don't actually remember this one that well. I feel like it was a match that the crowd wasn't particularly into. They did a lot of good stuff. Debbie definitely fits in with the AJW style, and I think she definitely acclimated herself here and going forward. She did even better. This was Takako's third defense. That not a ton to it.
Yeah, it was very grounded, very methodical, very realistic. I definitely just felt a bit weird, given that, Debbie Malenko is known for these really hot tag matches, and Takako Inoue is obviously more associated with dropping people on their skulls. I don't know. I thought it was good for what it was, but I definitely think it was a bit too just grounded and slow paced to kick off a show like this, I guess, for us. Maybe had we seen one of the hectic, I assume hectic, undercard matches, it would have flowed a bit better. But as far as an opener goes, it wasn't fun seeing such a slow paced, working the leg kind of match.
Yeah, and it felt like the crowd definitely didn't help it. The crowd was very not particularly into it, I would say. Near the end, it started getting a bit of energy, but Takako ended up just beating Debbie with the Aurora Special. Like you said, not a lot to it. This was Takako's third defense, like I said, and it was actually Debbie's second title match in AJW. One that we didn't get to cover, and a kind of important one going forward, was against Kyoko Inoue, who Kyoko won the IWA title in August. It was vacated before that. And so the IWA title is now in contention. It was reintroduced in August. And we just, we knew, but I did not realize that already happened, because there was no, they didn't even fucking mention it. So IWA title comes back. You know a bit more than I do about that specific title, because you've watched more of the lower card AJW matches over the next couple of years. What do you feel the IWA title coming back means to AJW?
I do wanna say that it's important, but I don't really think it is until they unify the three of them later on down the line, when Kyoko, I think, holds all three at the same time. I think you kind of see it pop up in the occasional work rate match when in AJW's, hey, we're just throwing shit at the wall, but here's cool matches, that kind of era. But I don't think it's going to be a super important belt for right now. But in saying that, most of my viewing of this era comes from AJW Classic, so that might have just completely cut out a lot of that stuff, but I don't think the belt itself is important for a little bit.
Okay, fair enough. It's strange that they have so many fucking belts and they just keep introducing more. Like, and like three or four of them do just have the exact same use, pretty much. Like, the junior belt and the AJW title are like maybe like 2 degrees separate. Like, obviously the junior belt is for like the true juniors, but like, wasn't Takako fighting for that belt like literally a year ago, less than maybe? Like, it's kind of wild. But yes, Takako retained the AJW title, and the IWA title got reintroduced. Kyoko is currently holding it at this time, but that is not really relevant for this show, so we should just move on into the semi-main event, because like we said, there was nothing on this show. Kyoko Inoue and Toshiya Yamada took on Akira Hokuto and Manami Toyota, a split match. Kyoko and Akira Hokuto were both obviously Bulls henchmen in a way, and Yamada and Toyota obviously members of Sekigun. Kyoko and Yamada come out with sombreros. Yamada has face paint on. They're really feeling it. And Hokuto is just like, yeah, I guess I gotta wrestle with Sekigun again. That's where we're at now. Besides the actual meat of the match, because there's a lot to talk about there, how did you feel about them putting these four together on this show, given that, you know, all of the things that are going on, the Tag League, the best is going on, Hokuto and Toyota are both sort of like on their way up as singles wrestlers. How did you feel about them putting this all together for a 31-minute match?
I guess it's kind of just how... I mean, you needed some kind of secondary match to pull in viewers, and I think one like this where, you know, you have four of their current top stars in a loaded tag match, especially with Kyoko and Toshiya Yamada just coming back from Mexico, it obviously made it an exciting addition to the card. So I guess it was just a good way to fill out the card beyond the main event, given that, you know, the main event had the 3WA belt, 30-way tag belts, and the All-Pacific belt tied up there. So this is really your only way to get a second big match on the card, to me.
Yeah, I think that's a fair analysis. The entrances are pretty elaborate for Kyoko and Yamada. Kyoko gets carried to the ring on the shoulders of Gokumonto members, which is kind of normal. They've carried Bull to the ring back when Aja was in Gokumonto. They did that, and like that was just like a normal thing. But Yamada made Sekigun carry her on her shoulders, and you could see the faces of the members of Sekigun. It's like, why the fuck do we got it? Like, we never do this. This isn't what we do. Why the fuck are you making us do this? This sucks. And it was kind of funny to me. And then yeah, they wrestle for a very, very long time. I'm not gonna say there wasn't any good stuff to it. I actually enjoyed this match more than I expected to. Because when you look at a match that is 32 minutes long, It was fine. I mean, it didn't progress properly, in my opinion. It felt like it didn't never leave first gear. It definitely left first gear, like, from the jump, but it felt like it never left the second gear, if that makes sense. Where it kind of was just sort of at a certain pace for like 25 minutes, and then it amped up for 3 minutes, and then it was over. You know what I mean? Like, that's how it felt, for me at least. I thought there was good stuff, there were some good spots, but that was my overall takeaway from the match. I don't know about you.
Yeah, so I think there were good bits, and then they would follow those good bits up with sitting in a submission for a while and or doing like medial tag work. It really just didn't flow at all, and they never really moved beyond, hey, we're just doing shit to do shit. And they didn't even fully embrace the doing shit. You know, they didn't go all out crazy, balls to the wall, like I know they can. They mostly just would, like, do random flashes and then back into rest holds and stuff like that. So it definitely didn't flow very well. And it definitely felt a lot longer than the 31-minute runtime. But there were some good parts, I thought, like Akira Hokuto and Toshiya Yamada, especially anything they did was a real highlight there.
Yeah,
and I thought they did some good bits, but a lot of it was you know, Tetsuya Yamada or Hokuto just like committing crimes on somebody. So
yeah, early Hokuto matches kind of had that issue quite frequently. But also she was still incredible, so like it was always hard to like judge some of her matches, because they would have like 15 minutes of just like super standard and boring, just like, you know, grinding, and then like 10 minutes of like the best wrestling you saw on the entire card. It's like, how do I feel about this particularly? And I think that was kind of the case here. I one part of this that was very like, I am not a tag rules person. I think tag rules are stupid. I understand why they exist, but like, I think that the whole revival thing where it's like, oh, they should be enforced to the, I don't really care that much. I just don't. But this match made me think maybe a little bit, because at one point Kyoko got beat the shit out of. Like, she got dived on. She got fucking hit with like a bunch of tag team moves. She was just out cold in the middle of the ring. And Yamada just walks in, drags her to the outside of the ring, and just is the legal person now. And I'm just like, that feels like that isn't how it works, like, at all. I mean, I'm cool with it, but I was so confused. But that was even impacted on later on when the ref gets more strict and says, no, you are not allowed in the ring, period. You must stay out. And I was like, but what? Just, it was so inconsistent. It was really hilarious to me. And I loved it. I loved that aspect of it. I thought it was just funny. Yamada ended up getting dropped on her head, as you would expect. I did not say why on my notes, but she did get dropped on her head. So that happened for sure. And yeah, I thought, I'm done. I think I'm done. Molly, what's the problem? Come on, come sit down. Come on. Good girl. So I liked the last few minutes of it. I thought it was fun. I liked the finish as well. Hokuto and Tiota hit like the meeting in the middle drop kicks. And then who went for the moonsault? Oh, they went for double moonsaults. And then Toyota got kicked out of the ring. And then, oh, that was the fit. I'm fucking all over the place. I apologize. Yeah, then Kyoko and Yamada hit a powerbomb Gamagiri combo after 32 minutes of wrestling, and they win the match. Like I said, I liked the finish. It was fun. I really like the powerbomb Gamagiri. I'm trying to remember the difference between an Enziguri and a Gamagiri. It's very difficult. But yeah, I thought it was fun near the end, but overall it was
cooler.
Exactly. And it's to the fucking face. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. Is Enzu is like, it's, you know, you hook your leg around the head. Whereas Gamen, you just kick him in the face. It's great. And Kawada does it, so obviously it's better. And yeah, it was a match that I think people would like. I think some people, if they're cool with 32 minutes of wrestling and they're cool with a little bit of grind work, they would enjoy it. But also, I understand why people would hate it. I'm somewhere in the middle. I thought that the good parts were definitely good, and I didn't hate watching it, but it was not necessarily a match for me personally.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, though, that the finish, Hokuto took the pin to Kyoko in a way, and I know Hokuto kind of took the two finishers at once kind of deal, but I thought it was surprising that she was the one who took the loss. Obviously she's more experienced than the other crew, so her losing to them at all is a bit of a surprising result, but especially since I thought she was in line for a bit of a bigger push in the near future as far as like our current timeline on the watch through goes. I don't know if like that was meant to be the finish, because it feels like she got her shoulder up and was maybe waiting for Toyota to break it up, and Toyota didn't because I think she was hurt. So I don't know. I just thought it was interesting to me that Kira Hokuto was the one to take the pin in this one.
Yeah, I agree. And also, yeah, within like a year, it feels like Hokuto does a lot more than Toyota does, even though Toyota in her own, realm does her shit and, progresses accordingly. But yeah, it was definitely a decision. Yeah, Toyota just got kind of kicked out of the ring and never came back in. So I don't know if they were going to go longer than 32, but I can see where you could sort of have that thinking that they might have gone a bit longer, though I think hopefully not, because that finish is very, very cool in my opinion. More people gotta do power bomb combos. I'm gonna say it. Fucking love that shit. Like the and like just like I remember when I was younger on eFeds, when I would have a tag team, my finish would be somebody doing a power bomb and then somebody doing the mushroom stomp on the person getting the power bomb and just breaking them. Like fucking, 'cause you know how the mushroom stomp it like really emphasizes on like the chest and head. Well, a power bomb, if you do it in combo, you just break their neck, and I think that's cool. So I think more people should do that, in my humble, humble opinion.
I agree.
Thank you. And now on to the main event, kind of asterisks. There's technically a match after it, but it kind of just bleeds into each other, so it's pretty much just one whole thing. It
Yeah,
is.
I think it was one match. I know Cage Match has it
Yeah.
as two. And I
It
guess, I mean,
was.
technically it is kind of like two, but like it's the one set thing. Because they are eliminated by the same process.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'm trying to figure out, like, was it always for the belt? Was it ever for the belt at all? Like,
Yes.
that's.
Yeah, I think it was always for the three-way belt, and the idea is that the winning team would then face off, and the last woman standing is the three-way champ.
That makes sense. Yes. It was, I don't know, man. It was kind of messy all around. It was a mess. The match itself was a steel cage Texas death match. It's a mouthful. Monster Ripper and Bull Nakano take on Jungle Jack, which is Bison Kimura and Aja Kong. Before this, Jungle Jack also had to do a performance at intermission. We didn't get to see it on this, but they told us on the documentary it looked pretty dope.
It
I actually
did.
love I love
It
the
was
Jungle
dope.
Jack
The song
performances.
was good too.
Yeah, I love those motherfuckers. Like they are so like you wouldn't expect it from Aja Kong and Bison Kimura, but they have like the most like energetic and just fun performances. I wish we got to see more performances. They're kind of hard to find because most, the intermissions weren't always recorded and they obviously weren't on HW Classics. So, it's very rare that we actually get to see some of these performances, but man, I adored so many of the performances back in the day. They were so fun to watch. They used them a lot in the documentary that we'll get into. As like they would have somebody singing like and doing the performance and they'd have like a montage of what's going on in the show, and it was really fun. But into the match itself, Monster Ripper says there'll only be one winner in this match, and it's going to be her, who is the real world's champion. For those who are confused by this, she was the WWC Women's Champion. If you're not aware, WWC is the biggest promotion in Puerto Rico. And yeah, she was holding the belt, but every source that I can find says that either she lost that belt like
Yeah,
a
I was
week
gonna
prior,
mention that.
or
Yeah.
at least like a couple days later. So she was not an undisputed champion. I'm pretty sure she was not champion at this point, and they were just like, just take the belt, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because I'm pretty sure she lost to somebody called Sasha in October. But she brought two belts with her anyway. And one of them was probably in Canada because I know she was booked a lot in Canada around that time. It was probably, I don't know, Stampede or whatever. But yeah, I'm like 90% sure every place I have seen too said that she lost the WWC belt anyway to somebody called Sasha. So I have no
Yeah,
idea.
so Monster Ripper might be a liar. Who knows?
I
Just,
mean, listen, she's a worker. I would
cool.
not be
Yeah.
surprised.
She's real famous. I don't know if you know about that. She's real famous worldwide. You should know who she
It's
is.
so bad because I love Monster Ripper. I think she's like I think very highly of her, but then every time I see her, I'm like, man, she's making it difficult on me.
Yeah, sometimes it's not always the easiest. The match itself was very, very unclear from the jump. So there were tag rules in this Texas cage match, steel cage. There were tag rules, Alex. They had to tag in only for like the first like 5, 10 minutes. After that, they just kind of did whatever the fuck they wanted. But they had to tag in. Why? That's so like I don't. Why do tag like? Maybe it's because I'm like a like I grew up with WWE, obviously, and the cages in WWE don't really have room to do the tag thing. But whenever I see like tags in a steel cage, it just looks wrong. Like they're supposed to be tornado. It does not make sense to me
See,
whatsoever.
I think it's because of the elimination element that maybe like it plays into the strategy or something.
Yeah, but it never played into the strategy whatsoever.
Well, kind of, because I mean, Monster Ripper was like, I'm not getting in the ring. And I was like, yeah, I wouldn't either, because if you are eliminated, you can't win the belt.
Yeah, but wait, but no, Bison, I'm pretty sure Aja Kong was not legal when she ate shit and died.
To be fair, she was bleeding from her
She was shoot
insides,
injured. Yeah,
so.
she was shoot injured.
Yeah.
But you know, technically with the glasses, you know what I'm talking about. It was just weird. But yeah, going into the match, a cage match said it was a 45-minute draw and then a 30-minute match. And I was very confused because I was like, there's only like 40 minutes left on this show. Like the DVD is gonna run out. I don't know what to expect here. Over time I sort of realized that it's like, oh, so it's an elimination match and this is how it's gonna go, and then Ripper and Bice and Boar are gonna have to wrestle and all that shit. And yeah, you know, nowadays it's so, you know, done to death that it's nauseating. But this match was a can they coexist match between Ripper and Bull, and I thought they did very well, relatively with it. I thought, like you said, there was this element of like psychology where it's like Ripper was like, "Nah, I'm not gonna help you. You just do your own thing." And then she would come in with a chain and be like, "Yeah, I'm beating the shit out of him." And then she'd go back and she'd be like, "Yeah, that's all you." But like, it was very smartly done, and but not done to death, if that makes sense, as we've seen over the past few years.
Yeah, no, it was. She picked her spots really well, which is good because by this stage, you know, Monster Ripper had a lot of wear and tear on her, so.
Yeah, totally. This match did have less plunder than like the match the year prior, which kind of sucks. I felt like the match the year prior was very specifically great because they had Jungle Jack and Gokumon Toe just throwing shit in the ring the entire time and like fighting on the outside. That was like probably one of my favorite cage matches of all time, was that the one at WrestleMania. It was so fun, the one the year prior, I mean. It was so fun. They just really were like constantly going at it, and obviously Bull is the queen of the cage match, so she kills it as always. Right around the 15-minute call, obviously there was a bunch of like schmozzing and just, you know, beating each other up with shit, all that Bull, get it? All that
That's
Bull.
terrible. I hate it.
It was a good joke. It was great,
It
even.
was not. It
15
was
minutes
not.
in. 15 minutes in, fuck you. 15 minutes in, Bison goes to the top of the cage and hits a flying headbutt on Bull, and she connects with it. And then Aja's like, "Hey, I think I could do that." And then she does not do that. She eats shit, and she is severely injured. On the tape, you can tell that it's like a shoot injury because like Bull had to stop Monster Ripper from going after her, and like Bull and Aja are supposed to like despise each other, but even Bull's like, "Hey, stop fucking around. You fuck, don't go after. Like, what the fuck's wrong with you?" Like, trying to be like, "Hey, why the f-?" Like, you don't usually see, and you see that in the documentary as well. You don't usually see these wrestlers like break kayfabe whatsoever, but Bull just being like, "Hey, don't just stop, bro. Like, she's actually dying.
Yeah,
Don't
you
go
could
near
see
her."
it too. Like the red was like going through her
Yeah.
gear. Like it was very visible. Like it was
Yeah,
really
it was
bad.
fucked. And she had just came back from a leg injury and surgery that, you know, took her out for only like a month and a half. She definitely was not ready to come back. But she did, and she kind of stayed back. She didn't really go out, I don't think, anytime soon after that, for an extended period of time at least. Just fucking insane. So Aja ends up being eliminated just because she can no longer compete. She screams, I can wrestle, I can go. And again, you see in the documentary that, like, because on the DVD, it's all grainy, kind of, and it's like, you know, from a hard cam shot for the most part. So you hear it and you see it, and it's like, oh, that's messed up. But when you actually watch the footage of the close up, it is like, it is fucked up. Like, it is brutal. Like, just the entire thing and her getting escorted to the back on the stretcher, it was all kinds of messed up overall. But with Kong no longer eligible to compete, this left Bison in a handicap scenario against Bull and Monster Ripper.
It kind of got weird here as well, because the Bison almost became the de facto babyface and was getting cheered for her comebacks because, like, she had these two monsters beating on her for forever, even though she's meant to be the heel. And I thought that was just a very strange section of the match.
Yeah, I mean, and this is like the biggest moment that Bison ever gets in wrestling, is this like 5 minutes, and it was all kind of like the crowd kind of like deflated as soon as Aja got seriously injured. So Bison just sort of had to make the best of it. She did start getting cheered a bit, but it was pretty quick that Bull and Monster just fucking demolished her and ruined everything. Not ruined everything, but just like killed her, to the point where she was no longer moving. After Bull hit a guillotine leg drop and Monster hit a big body splash, they eliminate Bison altogether. So that team, Jungle Jack, is completely gone. And so Monster Ripper says, fuck you, I'm going to beat you up now too. And they start wrestling. It was Monster Ripper versus Bull Nakano for the 3WA championship. This is the last, you know, thing, I guess. So for context, again, on Cage Match, it said that the tag match was completely separate from the Monster Ripper Bull Nakano match. Mm-hmm. It was not whatsoever. Literally, the second that Bison was eliminated, it became the singles match. Can we
like give credit to Bison, because she sold it like death.
Oh,
not a referee tried to carry her out, and she was like dead legged and everything. I was like, she is committed to this bit. And also, I loved the fit from Bison Kimura, the jean jacket and the jeans.
Oh, 100%.
Good shit. Yeah, you may continue. I wanted to give credit there to Bison, because I thought it was very
funny. What? No, you're right. I should give a bit more credit to Bison. I am personally a big Bison Kimura fan. This year, it sort of became clear that Aja was the big dog in Jungle Jack, and Bison was the slightly smaller dog in Jungle Jack. But I do think that her output this year was incredible. And, you know, I said it from the jump that it's like, oh, this is going to be Bison's year. She does a lot. And she did do a lot, even though it always ended up kind of ending the same way as it did here, with her getting hit with the leg drop and knocked unconscious and being carried out in a very cool looking outfit. It seemed like that was the story of her year. But I do think that Bison Kimura doesn't get enough love. I think a lot of wrestlers from this era don't get enough love, especially Jungle Jack members. I think it's becoming, clear that it's like, yeah, Aja Kong was the star of Jungle Jack, but like, I don't think any member of Jungle Jack was even like bad. Like, even like the rookies of Jungle Jack, even like Kyoro Ito at this time was in Jungle Jack. Like, she was great, you know, like, and she was like very, very inexperienced at this point still. That, and you know, like, obviously Kamea, like, they, Jungle Jack does not get enough love, because obviously people know about Gokumanto, they know about the Atrocious Alliance that sort of became Gokumanto, but they don't really know much about Jungle Jack outside of it's Aja's group, and they had that one tag match against Bull and Grizzly, I mean. So I think people need to put some more respect on Jungle Jack's name, because they did always do great with what they were given, all of them. And yeah, so shout out to them. Thank you for stopping me, because I would have gone on without spouting my love for Jungle Jack and all of their accomplishments up to this point.
Indeed. Yeah, well, that's, yeah, have to give credit to the Jungle Jack.
You added nothing.
I was going to mention that it is really weird how they don't get much acclaim, given that, you know, I always associate the periods of AJW that people know with Dave Meltzer and his ratings, because obviously a lot of people use those as kind of a litmus test. But he was fairly generous to the, like, Jungle Jack in this era. Like, he gave, for example, like, he gave their match with Bull and Kyoko in a way 4 3/4. He gave the match with Esther and Manami Toyota 4 3/4. He gave the other Bull and Kyoko match 4.5. Like, it's weird how he rated their matches highly. Like, they have matches rated higher than fucking Kandori and Hokuto 2, and yet a lot of people haven't seen them, which I find strange, because generally, if somebody has received kind of that sort of acclaim from Dave Meltzer, it will have seeped into some people's consciousness. But I guess maybe because he didn't give those matches 5, people don't know them as much, or maybe it's just because it's not Manami Toyota or Akira Hokuto who have kind of lived on beyond AJW. But yeah, I do think it's weird how little this era is talking about, given how many highly rated matches it has by somebody with as much sway as Dave Meltzer.
I do think, as somebody who is a bit newer, I can't really say that anymore because it's been like 2 years now, but a bit newer to the classic Joshi scene, I think a lot of people see it as 93 was the year that it picked up. So by 93, Bison had just retired. Aja was a world champion. She was more teaming with Bull more often than she was, you know, teaming with anybody else. And even then, she wasn't teaming with Bull that often either. And they either associate with 93 to like 95, or they associate it with Bull Nakano. And Bull Nakano was the leader of Gokumonto, and her adversaries were Jungle Jack, but Bull Nakano was the star. So I think that sort of plays into it with like the perception of like, okay, everything from 93 on until like 95, 96, when Gaia became a thing, and when Argeon started forming up, and a bunch of other smaller promotions started jumping up, and, you know, got a bit saturated the market. Those years, 93 to like 96, were the years that everybody pays attention to. So I think 92, 91, when Jungle Jack was truly at their top and on their game, people don't really recognize that as much, which is a shame, because, you know, obviously 91, in my opinion, as we finish up the year, was not as good as 1990. I still think that there was a lot of great stuff, and a lot of it had to do with Jungle Jack. You know, obviously Bull, it was always the star of the show, but Jungle Jack was definitely the best people you could put in the role as her head adversaries. So yeah, shout out to Jungle Jack. Now I guess we should probably get into the whole rest of the match that was fun.
I mean, I don't know. It was just like Battle of Titans who were using weapons and shit. Like, it wasn't like Monster Ripper is very limited, as I said before, by this point. But I mean, she has enough size and enough aura that her and Nakano just like trading weapon shots was fairly cool. Even if it didn't live up to the first part of the match where Jungle Jack were bringing extra chaos.
Yeah, and I think that was the main thing, is that it didn't feel like there was like enough like unique weapons for it to feel like, you know, the chaos was there. You know, and I bring back the one, excuse me, this fruit punch is making me gassy. It brings me back to the cage match at WrestleMania PAD 90, was there was so much shit. It was like there was so much shit going on. There was so many weapons. There was like every second there was a new weapon in somebody's hand and they were fucking murdering the other one with it. And it was great. And then it all led up to the finish. Whereas this one, it sort of felt like they were just like trying to find like weapons and like use them properly. And it was a bit more clumsy, which, you know, Monster Ripper, like you said, is a bit more limited. But on her game is quite good. I do think that the Ripper versus Bull match from earlier in the year was better than this little end segment, which is strange because usually Bull's matches are just heightened in the cage. I feel like she, like I said, she's the queen of the cage match. She's like one of the best cage match wrestlers of all time. So, I mean, that might have taken away from it a bit, but overall, I thought it was fun. And eventually, it ends in the most fitting fashion, which is, of course, Bull going to the top, hitting the guillotine leg drop from the top of the cage, third time she's ever done it, and she eliminates Monster Ripper and deems herself the last woman standing and still 3WA World Women's Champion. Yeah, a bunch of pyro goes off. Monster Ripper starts screaming. She's like, I'm still the real world champion. I'm still the real. And then she like gets, you know, booed out of the building.
Oh, yeah, title for title. We'll do title for title. And I was like,
do they ever wrestle ever again?
I don't believe so.
Like, maybe
sure
in the WWF?
Off to Mexico. Like, I'm pretty sure she folks off to Mexico. Let's see.
And
apparently, she wrestled Hokuto
eventually.
In November. The day after WrestleMania, she wrestled Akira Hokuto. But, no match with Nakano. No singles match with Nakano that I can see, anyway.
So it was the Kelly Klein joining Oedo tie of this. I see.
Yeah, I think it was probably just that, like, maybe they wanted to set up another Birth of Fae, or not Birth of Fae, Monster Ripper Nakano match. Yeah. They wanted to set up the match, and then maybe Monster Ripper was like, well, fuck no, I'm not losing. So they were like, okay, then go fuck off to Mexico, because that's where she spends the next 3 years, is AAA. So, I don't know.
Yeah. So, no more Monster Ripper. It was fun while it lasted, but she kept her heat after the match, yelling title for title while getting booed out of the building. And, yeah, Bull continues to cement her status as...
I hated that, by the way. Despise that. Her, because the visual of Nakano standing tall with the smoke coming out of the cage and you know, all that sort of stuff,
it was
cool. Really cool. And then you just have fucking Monster Ripper having to get her heat back, shouting over us, title for title, I'm the real champion. I was like, can you not just let the ace of the promotion have her moment? But no, apparently not. And I don't know,
dude,
what,
imagine if at WrestleMania, like, Triple H just got in the mic after Roman Reigns beat him or whatever, and was like, no, I demand a rematch, like, and, like, actively, like, because, like, obviously, like, they'll, like, talk shit or whatever, but, like, after the match, and just, like, actively making a whole thing about, I mean, WWE's done worse, trust me, but it's just really funny, like, when you think about it, like, a normal ending of a huge show, nah, I'm just gonna yell into the mic and keep my heat.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair, she was very old school. I get the mentality, you know, of keeping your heat, making yourself look good. But I definitely, if I was AJW, I'd have been like, listen, this is our moneymaker. You fuck off. but yeah, you know, it didn't really matter. Nakano got on the microphone and she yelled at her and people cheered. She got a big pop for winning as well, Nakano. I thought that was very cool. This was, I remember, like, going through when I watched this match, this is when I realized, okay, Bull is the babyface hero now, because, like, she got such a big reaction to the win.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. Yeah, she's just the god now. That's where she's at. And she stays the god for like another year around. Even though I don't think she defends the belt much over the next year, if at all. Like, maybe like once or twice. Which is a bit strange.
Another
of
the Kong match. And there's an Akira Hokuto match definitely in there somewhere.
But was it for the belt?
I would assume so. Actually, I don't think so, because I think she loses, so no.
Yeah, because Hokuto wins that match, yeah. That's what I mean. She wins by over the cage, though. So, I mean, like, but still, like, she loses that match.
Hurry win, like, because, Bull don't lose clean.
Exactly. But yeah, so now a lot, like, we'll see what Bull does for the next year, because I don't really remember. Like, I know that the Hokuto stuff pops off, but that's more of a Hokuto thing than a Bull thing. But that's besides the point. We'll get into that when we get into that. Now we have a little bit of an extra, as I've been talking about and I've been alluding to this entire time. There is a French documentary episode. It's not a documentary. It's like an episode of a TV show about AJW, and it just covers some tour shows from the fall, and it climaxes WrestleMania Piad. Have you ever watched this before, or was this your first time viewing it?
First time, yeah.
Yeah, first time? Okay. Because I'm very new to the world of Joshi documentaries. I've only ever seen the wrestlers episode, which I personally love. And even that sort of had like a depressing aspect of it. I've realized that Joshi wrestling is a very depressing thing. And nobody is in it except for people who either were miserable, are miserable, or is like, I don't know. Yeah, I think that's it. Like that's
it's a real island of misfit toys. Even like Stardom, like Mayu Iwatani is the classic case there. She like didn't leave her house for 3 years, and then I think her brother or something took her to Dragon Gate, and she was like, "I'm gonna run away and be a wrestler." And you're just like, "All right, cool." And that was the case for a lot of them, I think. Is that,
and
like,
she didn't win for like a year. She was called the runt. Like she wasn't bullied necessarily, but like she did not have an easy time early on either. Like, and it's Joshi wrestling's like, I mean, and then I was talking about it before, I had never seen it before and I still haven't seen it. I'm kind of scared to watch it through its entirety, but Gaia Girls is just like fucking massively depressing from everything I've seen, especially considering the context of the main girl that they were talking about, retired like 2 years later. Joshi wrestling is just,
I think some of the Gaia Girls thing was played up for the cameras. I remember,
yeah, for sure,
Ryo Mizunami did a podcast and she was asked about it and she was like, yeah, I'd seen the videos and like I was very wary, but like when I went there it was nowhere near as bad. So I think some of it was put on for the cameras, just like it was here in some ways. Like this documentary definitely felt like the filmmaker was being worked a little bit and wanted to tell like a very biased story. And you kind of see some of the negatives shine through, but a lot of it is like a full-on work, which I think some of Gaia Girls was too.
Yeah, it's I think that's definitely the case. And it's funny in comparison to the, again, like, cause I'm basing my knowledge of Joshi documentaries off of three specific things. It's this, Gaia Girls, and the wrestlers, right? In the wrestlers, Kagetsu is like the nicest trainer of all time. Like, she, like, it is the most wholesome. Like, you are watching it and you're like, this is the most wholesome dojo I have ever seen in my entire life. Mm-hmm. So it's funny that there was that report that Kagetsu was a monster of a trainer, because that's just like, obviously, again, working the cameras is a very big thing in Japan and in, you know, Joshi, but like, I don't know, that it's just very funny to me. But we should probably stop talking about everything else and all the other documentaries and just get into this one. Like Alex said, it sort of like starts with like knowing that they're getting worked. Like the friend, like the people who are making this documentary are definitely getting worked. It starts kind of with like an intro that's about, you know, knowledge and, you know, cultures and all that shit. So it kind of speaks to how influential and big Joshi wrestling was to the culture of Japan in the early 90s. That a random French TV show about cultures around the world, and that had nothing to do with wrestling, just sort of like pinpointed it and like dived into it. And yeah, so like I said, they were kind of kayfabed here. I don't know what you would call him, the host. He says, these women get the hell beat out of them. They're forced to cut their hair, which part is partially true, but not in the way that he said it. He's kind of being like, oh, and it's humiliating after you lose a match and have to cut your hair. And it's like, no, they just made you cut their hair, your hair, or you'd be fired. It was very different. That's entirely a different story. And then he also says, they do not get paid when they lose, which, like, is just not true. Like, and if it is true, then that's like, that's not, like, it's not true. You know what I mean? Like, that's just not how wrestling works.
They also, they were clearly embellished. They also really embellish the earnings of the top ones as well. They're like, oh, Bull Nakano makes all of this money, and Aja Kong makes all this money, and I'm pretty sure
it wasn't. It wasn't that much money.
Yeah,
because I have the notes that
I still think it's a bit embellished, because I know Bull Nakano in an interview like last year was like, yeah, when I went to WWF, they're paying me like 10 times what I made in AJW as champion, and I was like, it's not great.
No, I think that's accurate. Because The conversions, basically, it starts with the payout of three wrestlers specifically. They say Bull Nakano gets paid roughly $450 per match, of American money, I mean. And then Manami Toyota gets paid $200 per match, and Aja Kong gets paid $275 per match, which, considering they wrestle like twice a week, three times a week even, like, that's a relatively normal pay for, like, what I would expect out of this. Like Bull getting paid $450 per match, that makes sense to me. Like, I'm like, considering she was the star of the show, that sounds like it makes sense. Also, a lot of it just plays into the how long you've been in the company. So Aja was in for a year longer than Toyota, so she got paid $75 more. You know, just like stuff like that. I don't think that they really embellish that much. And if anything, I think that they probably get paid a bit more, or a bit more flexibly, than the way that they sort of played off. Because, like, I imagine Bull gets paid, like, at least a couple dollars more for a cage match than she does for, you know, a tag match in Sendai with 20 people there. Not 20, you get what I mean. They say the earnings, which is interesting, even though it might have been a bit kayfabe, like we talked about before. Do you have any things to say about the early parts of this before I keep talking? Because I need to take a sip of my drink, because I've been talking a lot.
No, I was just trying to find the quote from Bull Nakano. She just said that she made 13 times more in WWE than for AJW. So, you know, take that for what it is. I do think that a lot of their stuff about, like, the low entry pay for rookies is true and probably still holds true.
Yeah.
I know historically the entry pay for Joshi Wrestling has been pretty horrendous.
Well, yeah, because, and it's a testament to, like, the difference of American and Japanese, is that in America, you pay as a trainee to get into a dojo or to get into a training center. Whereas in Japan, they pay you, but they also make you work, and they also treat you like shit, and they also don't pay you almost anything. So it's like that's sort of the contrast there between American and Japanese, is that you don't have to pay to go to the training, but You're not going to get paid a lot, and also you're going to die. That's sort of the way that dojos work. Obviously, I'm being hyperbolic. They don't seem that bad. Most of the girls seem like they're pretty, not that they're treated well, but they're not treated poorly, except for Akemi, which we'll get into later. Very depressing story. A lot of this documentary was just sort of depressing. Not because anything was inherently depressing, but just because, like, you realize that this is just the life of a professional wrestler. And this is the life of a professional wrestler who's signed to a company who is the biggest in their field. And you hear things from Bull, like, she doesn't have any personal life. This is the first time she's talked to somebody who's not a wrestler or in wrestling in, like, years, she says, other than her family. And then she talks about her age, and she says, and I'll quote this, "You know, I'm 23 years old. I'm an old person. I'd like to keep going until I'm 30, seeing as they've raised the age limit a bit, but I don't know if I can do it staying here. I might break down. They expect a lot out of me." And, like, you know that. As a wrestling fan, you know all those things are true, and as a Joshi wrestling fan specifically. But the way that she says it, very, like, yeah, this is just how it is, it almost breaks you as a viewer. Because it's like, damn, that's just, like, that's just her reality. And that's the reality of a lot of wrestlers. And I was like, I'm kind of sad now. And it just kept getting sadder as the time went on, I'm going to be honest.
It's especially the company that they're in.
Yeah.
Like, I know AJW eventually got rid of the 25 rule and was like, you know, we're not going to force you all to retire. But it was very much... we may not force you to retire at 25, but we're going to break you by 25 and you will retire anyway.
Yeah.
That's always the vibe I got. Like, their schedule is hellacious. The matches are crazy and it takes a toll, especially when you start so young. It's like, I thought it was crazy. Like, when Bull Nakano said, "I'm 23, I'm old." I was like, "I'm 23. Like, I right now,
you are
I'm
old.
23. Yes. But I was like, that's just insane. But in terms of AJW, that is, you know, 2 years away from retirement for most people. And also, that is 8 years of wear and tear of their very hectic schedule on your body. So I can kind of understand what she meant. And I don't think it's probably the same now where a wrestler is there for 8 years and they're like, yes, my body is breaking down. It's definitely a sign of the times more than anything. I think nowadays wrestlers probably have it a lot easier. And we also know a lot more about the benefits of recovering and giving people rest, because obviously Stardom or any Joshi company would never think to run the schedule that AJW did, you know?
Yeah. She did mention that they raised the limit to 30, so she could theoretically wrestle to 30, but which I didn't know. I thought that they just did away with the limit, but I guess 30 sort of makes sense. That they, you know, just to be safe, even though most are still retiring by 26, 27. And yeah, from there, there's just some, like, you know, house show stuff. They talk about their idea of, you know, the way that they market, that they go to the smallest towns possible who are dying for some type of entertainment. You know, places that don't have, you know, as many TVs or, you know, like, not they don't have TVs, but just places that are a bit more, like, craving something to excite them. They go there and they just fucking, like, abuse that. And, I mean, that's a very smart, especially for the 90s, that was a very smart idea and a very smart marketing tactic. I don't think it would work anymore because I feel like, you know, if somebody's in the rural area, they're there because they want to be there and they don't necessarily need to be, you know, excited every month because they get nothing else. They probably have some type of TV or, you know, just the advances of electricity and all that other bullshit that I don't feel like getting into here. But they talk about that and how that's a very smart way to do business. They also, the French commentated about how there are many Yakuza hanging out, but the boss doesn't want to be filmed. And I was like, these motherfuckers are going to get killed. Like, they're just fucking around. They're like, oh, look, there's the Yakuza boss. He doesn't want to be filmed. Haha. It's like, you're gonna get murdered. That's it. You're not far from getting hurt severely. But it does sort of cement that thinking that Yakuza organizations had a stranglehold on wrestling venues. Blah, blah, blah. Bull is cool. There's a lot of the famous shots you see of Bull, like, on the internet of her just, like, doing things are from this documentary. So her going from the ring, going through a crowd of insane fans, and immediately sitting down at the merch table and signing autographs, like, right out of her fucking hellacious match, that was taken here. The scene of Bull playing Mario while Akira Hokuto takes care of her dogs, most wholesome shit ever, that was also here. Briefly, Shinji Ueda, the president of AJW, talks highly of Takako Inoue and Saki Hasegawa as they take, you know, footage of the training back at the AJW dojo. Again, it looks hellacious as, you know, dojo practice is, but it doesn't look as, you know, it wasn't as worked as something like Gaia Girls, where it's like, oh, they're just killing this person. It was a bit more just like, you know, grinding
ring work.
People, yeah, away. Yeah, a lot of grinding people away crazy. To prove that they're something. But yeah, so early shout to Takako Inoue and Saki Hasegawa. They both obviously become a bit more popular, and they obviously had the eyes of the president of AJW, so that's a good sign early on. And then we get to Akemi. Would you like to talk about this? Because, like, I don't want to. Like, I'll talk about it, but I don't want to.
Oh, because this is bad. Like, it's... They mention later on that they didn't recruit her the normal way. They wanted specifically somebody to fight Bat Yoshinaga. So they took her. So she wasn't, like, trained the normal way. She wasn't recruited the normal way. And you could tell that because she didn't pan out, they didn't like her. And so they used her as the training dummy, and she would just, you know, she was getting tossed 100 times or more. And obviously she's, you know, she was a bit bigger, so obviously it's probably harder to carry her. And she herself was inexperienced and not trained as a wrestler. So they were just very much like, well, if she gets seriously injured, don't care. You know what I mean? And it always kind of felt a bit weird about Teresu because, like, they would put her out there in all these shoot fights against more experienced, trained fighters, and she would just get the shit beat out of her. And now you see that they genuinely didn't care about her well-being. Like, if she... I feel like they wanted her to either quit or get seriously hurt and forced to retire. That's the vibe I get, is that they did not care if she was okay or not. Like, they were... They made a decision on a whim to take her in, and then were like, yeah, well, she didn't really beat Bat Yoshinaga, so she's of no use to us. So it was like having her as the training dummy, as they called her, the training dummy, is so irresponsible and dangerous. And you can just tell by the way they spoke about her and the way they booked her that, like, they just didn't care if she got hurt, and they were probably hoping that she did so they wouldn't have to deal with her.
Yeah, it was kind of fucked, because, like, one element of it was Hokuto, Bull, and somebody else was in a room, and Akemi came to them, and Bull was like, she needs new socks, because she can't be walking around with no socks, or, like, something of this, like, shoes or something. And Akemi looked at them like they just were the nicest that she's ever been treated. And I was like, that is terrible. You're... co-workers are like offering to, you know, buy you shoes or something because you don't get paid anything, you get beat up every day, and you're a public figure to a degree, so you need to look, you know, presentable. And that's like she just smiled, like that was the nicest thing anybody had ever said to her. And I was like, that's terrible. Also, there are like shots, like there's like b-roll of her on the bus with bruises from her MMA fights and all that shit. Just terrible, honestly. It really, like, I don't know. I'm a sadistic guy, but this even like kind of disgusted me. You know what I mean? Like it was gross.
Yeah, especially from AJW, a company where there are wrestlers on record saying some things about their treatment of trainees. Like, and even if you dive deeper into some things, like I remember, I think Dump Matsumoto was like infamously like really nice to her juniors, and some of the other senior wrestlers were like, "What the fuck are you doing? Like, why are you being nice to them? Stop it." So yeah, I think it's not good at all. Yeah, I mean, it's nice to know the Bull was kind of nice at least.
Yeah, and I mean, seeing as she was, you know, the junior of Dump, I imagine that some of that probably rubbed off on her. Of just not being a piece of shit, which, you know, I feel like a lot of this documentary did focus on Bull and her, I don't want to say her mental issues, but like just her mental fatigue a lot. And we see it a lot when she goes and has dinner with her family, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But first we have to talk about Minami Toyota's family, who she, this like, it got dark really quickly. I'm gonna be honest, like that Akemi stuff and then this Minami Toyota stuff and then Aja stuff, like it gets really dark really quick. So first the Akemi stuff where she's getting, you know, just demolished and just being treated really terribly, and then we get to Minami Toyota, who her family comes to a show. By her family, I mean her dad and her sister, and they come to a show and they interview her dad, and he says that I fucking hate wrestling. I think it's disgusting. I think it's street fighting, but I have to remember that's just what she does. And then they get to the point where they talk about her mother, and her and her father go to her mother's grave, and Toyota sort of talks about how her mother was the only one who supported her wrestling. So after her mother died, her family was demolished, and they just, their relationship was nothing. And again, like with the whole, you know, documentary crew kind of being very biased in a way, they kind of said some shit here that I was like, that's distasteful. You don't say that to like a subject of your documentary, where it's like her family is completely destroyed and she has no love for them anymore. I was like, did she say that? That's a bit, like that's a weird voiceover line from a random French dude. But yeah, that's where Minami Toyota is at that point. And it's really fucked. And then we get into Aja Kong also telling her story about her family and how her mom died when she was 17, and her father abandoned her when she was 5. He moved to New York, and she said that her goal is to become super famous and go to America where she can meet her estranged father because he has to know what she looks like. And dude, this entire thing was just, and like when I saw that, I was like, shit, that was heavy. And I paused it And then being stupid, I looked up like Aja Kong Family, and there was another documentary. Mm-hmm. It was like 7 minutes mm-hmm. long. Also depressing. It was from a couple years ago. Also incredible. Like, it made me way more depressed. I was like, that made it worse. It did not get better.
No.
Oh man, it was rough.
Didn't she go on like the Japanese version of like Who Do You Think You Are or whatever it is to like search for him, and she could never find him. It's really
I didn't see that. I saw something different.
All right, yeah, I saw one that was sure about.
She talked about the abuse her mom. It was, oh my god.
Oh yeah, because I wrote about like her issues with racism before. I did a lot of a lot of research into it. Like her mother was like almost ostracized from the family for daring to sleep with a man of color who was American and stuff like that. Like she had a very tough time, and then she went on a TV show, I believe, to try and find her dad, and it didn't work out. So I don't think she ever actually met him, which is very heartbreaking.
And he did. He passed at some point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a lot. All of this was a lot. But after that, we kind of get worked, and I was kind of missing getting worked. So Aja Kong and Bull Nakano talk about how they prepare for their big match and how much they despise each other and how much Bull wants to preserve her name and how, you know, all of that stuff. And I'm just like, thank you for making me feel a little bit less depressed for a second and just getting to see Bull play pachinko for a bit and see Aja like try on fashion, like, you know, like, I guess it would be like thrifting. Like she was just going around thrifting shit and stuff. And I was like, that was nice for those 3 minutes. And then we get to see Aja get injured severely in the WrestleMania match. And it is very bad. Yeah, it went back to depressing very quickly.
Yeah, oh, even man. The documentary makers knew, because they were like, when it happened, they were like, this was all avoidable. And I was like, yeah, like this, like, dude. Easier to be let her go out there. They probably told her to go out there and wrestle that match and do the performance coming off of surgery. And they, like, risked her life. Like,
yeah.
You know? What happened to her is not normal at all. Like, that was very, very bad. And it was on their time.
Even...
I know we shouldn't say this, but I'm so glad what happened to the Matsunaga brothers, because they just so clearly had no care for the lives of these people. Like
Rossi Ogawa cares about the wrestlers more than any official in the company. And this is not even disrespecting Rossi, but we all know Rossi.
I feel like I know we didn't mention it here, but there's a Dump Matsumoto show come Netflix. I don't think that's what they're going to aim.
I imagine they'll go
but
for
it's
glow,
there if they want it.
Like a Japanese glow type of thing, just a bit like in that, like, because glow had so many issues, and I haven't watched the entire series. I imagine they touch on the issues, but like the glow series is more like, oh, glow sounded cool, like that sounds like a cool premise, more so than like, this is fucking disgusting and why do women wrestle, because that is terrible, when in actuality glow had a lot of problems. Very clear problems.
Sure.
So I imagine it'll go more for that audience more than like the Dark Sides of the Ring, but in drama form audience, if that makes sense. Excited for it either way. I know we didn't talk about it, but yeah, that is coming, and it is super exciting because I'm so ready to watch that. In other news, also pertaining to the endangerment of all of these women in this wonderful company, Bull Nakano hit that big guillotine from the top of the cage. Everybody loves it, including me. I think it is incredible to watch. It's like just astounding. But when you hear her talk about it, she mentions how before she did the first one, she was told, "You're going to get paralyzed. Don't do that." And she did it, you know, the first time she did it. And then they were told, "You're lucky that your tailbone isn't broken. Don't do that again." She did it two more times. In fact, three more times, because there's one that we have not seen yet that happens next year. And Bull says, "I got to put on a show. I got to do what I got to do to defeat my opponent." And I don't think we have time to unpack all of that. But Jesus Christ. Like, it just keeps getting worse when you actually think about it. past that, past WrestleMania, oh yeah, they also dip into the fact that Debbie Malenko was not getting paid for that night because she lost, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
Like they got like the most random B-roll of her just like tired after the match, and they're like, she's depressed because she will be homeless. I was like, I don't think that's, I don't, okay. That's just funny to me. After WrestleMania, Bull goes to see her family. They also show the actual restaurant that AJW runs, which, you know, houses a lot of the recently retired wrestlers and also the trainees and all that stuff. I would have loved to go to that restaurant. That sounds really interesting, to say the least. But, you know, obviously, let's not talk about human rights, but, you know, it sounds fun. And yeah, they also talk about mini wrestlers and how they weren't exploited for sure. The president of AJW was very quick to be like, they aren't being exploited. Trust me, we're feeding them. They're getting paid. We're not exploiting them. And I was like, okay. And then they just get to the last few minutes of the documentary. Bull has dinner with her family, and her father shows some childhood footage of Bull, and Bull looks very just distraught almost. Just like just completely out of it at that point, and they sort of like flash that together with a bunch of just like videos of her wrestling and how like that's like the goal was that wrestling has corrupted her. Even though that's not necessarily how that, you know, I think that was very liberal liberal use of creative direction by the documentary crew. Yeah, and then after that they just got into some like how this impacts the real world, and they get into how the popularity of amateur wrestling in Japan amongst women grew from there. And even now there are, you know, many, many gold medalists in amateur wrestling from women. And
that
back then
so
there were none.
Weird, wasn't it?
So
like,
that,
she was
that's
like,
huge.
I
and, like,
never,
just
like, she
stuff
was
like
that.
They get to Dump Matsumoto's
never
retirement and
never
how
here.
She was
this
happy
place sucks.
To not have
like,
to wrestle
is,
for AJW ever
nuts.
Again. and yeah. Yeah. I think she specifically met her company.
It's weird though,
with AJW. That's how it sounded.
Back to AJW,
like obviously she said Japan,
like,
but like I feel like,
isn't she?
Especially
yeah,
at that point,
like,
there were no other companies other than JWP. I don't think she would go to JWP anyway. That was just sort of like,
yeah.
Oh shit! Did she? Well, by 03, it's kind of died. Yeah, I don't think it's even remotely the same company by then. Even though it kind of is, but you know, just post Exodus and pre Exodus are completely different, and especially into the 2000s, in my opinion. But yeah, so that was it. And then they sort of talk about how like there are so many people. Yeah, Bull Nakano exists. Yeah, Dump Matsumoto exists. Yeah, Manami Toyota is getting up there, but like most women just don't make it, and they just ruin their bodies for nothing. And that was the goal of the documentary was why do they do it? Because they're stupid and want to be stars. And I think that's a bit reductive, but at the same time it's kind of true for some cases. My final thought was that this felt like a Dark Sides of the Ring that was happening, that was recorded while it was happening. It could have been way worse, but it definitely was just like there were certain bits where you just felt very uncomfortable, where it's like, damn, this is just like, this is what Joshi is, especially at this time.
Yeah, I
period.
Mean, it.
But
it was
also
so
fun
weird.
To see Bull
it felt
hang
like
out
they were
and just
trying
do,
to do a smear
like her normal
piece,
things
and
be
then
in her natural
somehow
state in a
managed
way.
To miss all
very,
of the actual
she
bad
seems
stuff
like a cool
and
person.
Instead got worked and smeared the fake stuff. So yeah, it was fun. Is.
Yeah. Which is kind of funny. Like I almost like that's probably the most respectable thing about this entire thing.
I don't know. It was,
is that AJW
was
just
an
like
interesting
yeah.
one. I think the thing is that like
we're about to make y'all
the worst
look like
parts
dorks.
Were what the wrestlers and even the staff just considered normal, and that really shared a lot about the environment of the company. And I think that was almost more smearing than some of the nonsense of if you lose you don't get paid. And Manami Toyota has a small apartment because she is a mid-carder, and I was like, no, she probably has a small apartment because she's never fucking there, like she doesn't need it. Yeah, but like she doesn't need a massive.
Yeah, and also, like, you look at that apartment. That's like it's not a normal apartment in Japan, but it's not a small. Like, Japan just has small apartments, bro. That's it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just how it is. Yeah, exactly. Which, if they dived into that, that could have been a very fair criticism. Is that it's like, oh, they're always on the road. What the fuck? But no, it's just, oh, she has a small house. And it's like, that's, yeah, so do I. Like, I don't get it. Like, so do a lot of people in Japan. It's just, it was a weird direction, but I'm happy that they did it because it was an interesting insight into what AJW is. Because I feel like Joshi is very smart and very selective with when they allowed their doors to be opened even a little bit. Obviously, everybody kept kayfabe here, but even a bit, you know, a bit of like, oh, well, this is like, there isn't a lot of intimate views of AJW in this sense. So it was fun to see for sure, even though there was a lot of baggage to it overall. Alex, do you have anything to say before we close the show? That's crazy, man. Neither do I, actually. Next month we will, or this month, I guess it's already December. I apologize, we're late. As always, it's kind of a tradition at this point. So whenever we record next, we will be talking about December in AJW and in FMW and maybe WWP. I don't know. We'll be doing some year-end stuff probably as well. I haven't really decided on anything, but that's what the plan is off the top of my head. Please come back. We will miss you if you do not. And yeah, thank you for listening. Obviously, we have Stardom Quest every week talking about stardom and the modern world of Joshi wrestling, the new Joshi meta, if you will. And we talk about that every week. We just recorded that before this, so if we sounded a bit tired, it's because it's been a long day for us. But thank you for listening. And in my opinion, I think personally, that what you should do immediately after I stop talking right now is tell your mom, tell your dad, tell your uncle, tell your grandma, tell your great-grandma, tell your great-great-great-great-great-grandma, tell your newborn niece, I love you, Eazy-E, so much. Tell everybody you fucking know that Victory Through Guts is the best classic Joshi wrestling podcast in the biz. Ijo, matane, arrivederci.